Then, as you remember, the 25% is provided by the applicant and 75% are funds from our hunter safety portion in the federal assistance account. The projects this time around include a pilot project with Brenham. He approved an initial planning grant for that Brenham project in April. This would comprise phase two of that project. And it is a pilot project because it is being administered by an independent school district, and obviously we feel the benefits of serving both the youth in the school system, but also the law enforcement and the local community all at once is a good project. There are two rifle and pistol range enhancement projects, one in Dallas and one in Waco. There's a road project at the largest range facility in Texas at the American Shooting Centers in Houston. And finally, we have a new archery range project on the shores of Lake Ray Roberts that was approved by the city of Denton and is adjacent to one of our state parks. Our recommendation, like Tim's, is as follows. The commission authorizes the executive director to execute the contracts funding projects A through E, pending the availability of those federal funds, and also, of course, an approved application, which goes through the same process that Tim described in terms of natural and cultural resource clearances. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions for Steve? We have a motion. I have no speakers signed up. Okay. Motion by Commissioner Holmes. Second by Friedkin. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Next item, we have operating capital budget. Mary?
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Mary Fields, Chief Financial Officer for Parks and Wildlife, and I'm here to present the proposed fiscal year 2007 operating and capital budget and the budget and investment policies for your adoption. Yesterday, I provided an overview of the proposed budget, and today I'll mention just a few key points. The 79th legislature appropriated $197.7 million to the department, and during the budget process, we identified adjustments and additional funds that brings our operating and capital budget to $295 million. Of that total, the operating budget represents $242.6 million, which includes $12.6 million for grants, and the capital budget is $52.4 million, which includes $48.9 million for construction projects and land acquisition. Our FTE cap for fiscal year 2007 is 2,901, and the department will stay within that capped amount. Since this is the second year of the 0607 biennium, we are basically carrying over several of the same issues that we dealt with in 2006, including the reductions that are highlighted on this slide. We based our budget on 100% of the 2006 base and added our contingency revenue of $8.5 million via Rider 27. We did not budget salary lapses at the beginning of the year, which is a change from prior years. We raised our capital limits to the maximum allowed at 125%. We applied the 3% pay raise for state employees. We continue to absorb inflationary costs for utilities and gas. And finally, we anticipate having the $15 million for the East Texas Fish Hatchery encumbered in fiscal year 2007 via contract, with most of the other unexpended balances that were discussed yesterday. That concludes my presentation on the proposed fiscal year 2007 operating and capital budget. I'll move on to the next item, which is to review the budget and investment policies for your approval. There have been no changes to the budget policy since the prior year, so I'm just going to touch on a couple of key points. The Commission authorizes the Executive Director to approve and execute necessary expenditures, budget adjustments, and transfers. Several different types of transactions are detailed in the budget policy. Budget adjustments excluding federal grants and bonds that exceed $250,000 require prior approval from the Chairman of the Commission and the Chairman of the Finance Committee. Moving on to the investment policy, again, this policy has not been changed since the prior year, but as the governing body of this department, you are required by statute to review this policy annually. All funds administered by Parks and Wildlife are required to be deposited in the state treasury, except for the four funds that are highlighted on this slide. While not required, all of these funds reside in the state treasury, except for the Operation Game Thief Fund. Those funds are invested in CDs in several separate bank accounts. All bank accounts must be authorized by delegated investment officers and must be properly collateralized. Specific reporting requirements are also included in the policy. If there are no questions relating to the operating budget and the policy, staff recommend the commission adopt the following motion as highlighted on the slide.
Thank you, Mary. Any questions for Mary? Commissioner Holmes. Got a motion to approve? Second. Holt, second. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, super combination, license rules, stamp, revenue allocation, Gene McCarty. Now, don't give me any guff now. Where do you keep going?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Gene McCarty. The item before you today deals with the allocation of net receipts from the sale of Super Combo licenses. As you may remember, in a recent audit of Fund 9, the State Auditor's Office recommended that the Commission define net receipts in the methodology it uses to allocate revenue from Super Combo licenses to dedicated stamp funds and allocate revenue accordingly. At the May Commission meeting, you authorized staff to publish a proposed administrative rule in the Texas Register that would define net receipts for the Super Combo license components, that's both the licenses and the stamps, and allocate as a value calculated from relative weighting using both the price of the stamp and the purchaser use as established by a dedicated survey. This rule was published in the Texas Register in the July 21st, 2006 Texas Register, and to date we've received no public comment. Also, as discussed in May Commission meeting, the Department has conducted a dedicated survey of Super Combo and Senior Super Combo buyers to determine license and stamp uses. The results to date are presented in this slide. When these results are applied to the 2006 Super Combo revenue, fund allocation falls out as depicted here. For comparative reference, I've also included a fund allocation schedule based on the old 2005 methodology. As you can see, there's some swinging of funds one way or another, but nothing really significant. Based on Super Combo survey results and comments received from in-house review, I would propose an amended administrative rule, but the amendments are intended to clarify and simplify the rule and provide for full utilization of survey data. Staff recommends the Commission adopt the following motion as depicted on this slide. Any questions?
Questions for Mr. McCarty? We have a motion. Commissioner Friedkin moves. Second. Commissioner Parker, all in favor, aye. Any opposed? Thank you, Gene.
Thank you.
Okay, I assume Ernie Gamage is going to give us a briefing, there he is, on the Parks and Wildlife Expo. You're the only one who can, Ernie, so we need you.
Mr. Montgomery, members of the commission, my name is Ernie Gamage, and I'm here to spend a second and tell you about this year's expo. This is our 15th annual expo, and through the expo, over these 14 years, we have touched over 500,000 Texans with the truth about the outdoors and outdoor recreation. And I hope you've had a chance, or you will have a chance, to look at the back walls and the lobby exhibit about Expo this year. Lots of changes at Expo. This is our 15th annual logo, which you'll be seeing on the grounds and around the building. The date, Friday, October 6th, is the Expo Conservation Dinner and Auction, and Saturday and Sunday, the 7th and 8th, is the actual Expo here at Parks and Wildlife Headquarters. A week later, we know that that'll make it about 75 degrees. I'd like to introduce Dick Davis right now, who will tell you about one of the most significant changes on site, which is the Conservation Dinner and Auction. Dick?
Thank you. As most of you already know, we are moving the
dinner and auction this year.
Can you give us your name and title for the record, please?
I'm Dick Davis, Executive Director of Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation. As I was saying, this year we're moving from under the tent here on the headquarters site to the new Lost Pines Resort that Hyatt has out on the Colorado River, just a few miles from here. Dinner is going to be a sit-down dinner this year. This year we're able to recruit for the first time some underwriters to help us pay for that event, and so things are looking very well for us to raise some substantial dollars for conservation this year. We have a high bar to try to get over, because last year Commissioner Parker set new standards in revenue generation, and we hope to be able to go beyond that this year. I put invitations on your desk in front of you this morning earlier. Those went out in the mail last week, so you've probably seen them. If you haven't, there is a list of some of the live auction items included in that envelope. And we have things ranging from a quail hunt in the panhandle that Commissioner Bivens has arranged for us with Nolan Ryan, to a hunt on the King Ranch, to a hunt on Commissioner Montgomery's ranch up in the North Texas Hill Country. I'll be guiding that. we hope that the governor will be joining us on one of these trips. Lieutenant Governor and the Speaker will be doing so on some. Senator Staples will be on some of those trips with us. But we have a lot of trips this year that transportation is being provided by Southwest Airlines. We have some other things like a safari to New Zealand. So we look forward to raising lots of conservation dollars in this new venue at the Lost Pine Resort, and honoring Joe McBride in the process. He is generally considered to be the father of the Expo, and he is a longtime sporting goods dealer here in town, a friend to most of us, a gun dealer to many of us, and just an excellent supporter of conservation, not only from the department and the foundation's side of things, but many other conservation organizations in this state are grateful and very thankful to Joe McBride. Thank you.
Any questions for Ernie or for Dick? Or Ernie, you want to have more further presentation? Okay.
Thank you, Dick. I would like to tell you what's new at Expo, because every year we try to change it up and bring some new and exciting things for our visitors. Because of some landscaping changes that were made last year right after Expo, we had an opportunity to do some remodeling to the grounds layout. And one of those resulted in a conglomeration of the law enforcement activities for the first time that will be right out in back of us over in parking lot A. All of the law enforcement activities will be there, including the wild game tasting. Also, the largest wildlife tent will be moving down this area to what was the wildlife watching area, and now will be virtually all of our wildlife presentations. Because that tent moved, we were able to relocate and reorient the main tent, which is literally right out here in front of us. So we'll see some changes on the ground. One of the most significant is moving the sporting dogs and birds of prey arena down to the far end of the grounds. This gave us an opportunity to really move an anchor activity at Expo so that folks will come all the way through the grounds in order to visit that very popular area. We have a new presentation that will be in the main tent called Outdoor Gear for Women, that will be presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Texas Bass Nation Federation will be presenting a Casting Kids competition for the first time, part of a statewide competition. Leave No Trace, which is a nationally recognized organization that promulgates 7 ethical principles for being in the outdoors, will be here with some activities. And we'll also have presentations from the off-highway vehicle and RV promotion folks to give information about the new off-highway vehicle permit, and also spots in Texas where you can RV camp. We will be recycling again at Expo after a year off. Returning will be shooting sports out in the back of the building, all the way from air gun to archery to crossbow to fire stand, fishing and aquatic presentations and activities in the parking lot out here. Have a lot of exciting things there. Tom Knapp and Julie Scarbina, as well as John Carter, will be back with their very, very popular shows. And probably one of the best things that we've ever done, which is the Outdoor Kids Challenge, which gives kids a chance from 6 to 17 to go around and do a little bit of everything at Expo, and in the process find out about what the great outdoors is all about and win some prizes. Do you have any questions? I hope that you'll plan to come. It's going to be a beautiful day.
Mr. Parker wanted to ask if you were going to have it as part of a shooting sport at this pond.
No, we opted to instead go with a feral cat toss.
I will publicly challenge Commissioner Parker if he will accept.
Outstanding.
News and information is preparing a release. We'll have my poster up here. Okay, any other questions for Ernie?
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ernie, before Dick left, but would you please convey to him, we do recognize the significant change here, having the foundation take on that effort. It's a big commitment for them. It's a lot of work for them. We appreciate them doing that. So make sure they know that.
I want to say that this package is the highest. I'll pass that on to those who
did. Okay, we're on to agenda item number 11, designation of representatives, foreign travel resolution. Lydia.
Good morning. Lydia Saldana, Communications Director. Two employees in the Communications Division have been invited to travel to other countries to conduct training and give presentations. The South African Hunters and Game Conservation Association has invited Terry Irwin, who many of you know. He's our Hunter Education Coordinator. He's also the current president of the International Hunter Education Association, and he's been asked to conduct training of their members. That organization is the newest member of the International Hunter Education Association. Kathy Manley, who's our Project Wild coordinator, and many of you met her during a presentation a few commission meetings back. She has been invited by the Parks and Recreation Foundation of Japan to speak about Project Wild and also to conduct some training workshops. Project Wild is starting to take off in Asia, and they've asked Kathy to come and show them how to do it. Travel expenses are being covered by these two host organizations, but just in case there's unforeseen travel expenses, we want to make sure that we're complying with the law, which requires y'all's approval. So we're asking you to approve the resolution that's in your package.
Thank you, Lydia. Any questions for Lydia on item 11, action item? Any comments? Let's see, we have a motion from Commissioner Friedkin, second by Parker. All in favor, aye. None opposed. Motion passes. Thank you. Item 12, briefing item on avian influenza. Mike?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Mike Berger, Wildlife Division Director, and we're here this morning to provide you with an update on the current status of avian influenza and the surveillance activities that we anticipate undertaking in Texas. I'm pleased to be joined this morning by Dave Morrison, our waterfowl program leader, and he will describe those surveillance efforts in just a moment. First, a little bit of background, and these are very important facts to be kept in mind at all times. There are no cases of HPAI H5N1 in North America. Surveillance for this virus has been in effect in Alaska since 1998, when this form was first discovered. It is a disease of birds, primarily water birds and poultry. Human deaths have occurred, and I'll report on those in a moment. The current form is not easily transmissible to human beings. Again, it is a disease of birds and poultry. Even if it is found in North America, if we discover it in a wild bird, does not mean that this is the beginning of a pandemic. And migratory birds may not be our biggest concern in that virus getting to North America, and we'll talk about that again in a moment. So what does HPAI mean? And as you can see here, it's highly pathogenic avian influenza on one side. It means it's considered highly pathogenic, likely to cause severe illness and death in poultry. This is an agricultural designation. It doesn't necessarily mean that it causes death or disease in human beings. The designated low or highly pathogenicity based on its potential to kill poultry, but it doesn't refer to its infectivity to humans or to wild birds. There are 16 different types of H, the hemagglutinin, and 9 types of the neuraminidase. That makes up 144 subtypes altogether that are possible. Avian influenza in water birds, so mainly in ducks, gulls, and shorebirds, are the natural reservoirs for this influenza. All 16H and 9N combinations do occur. AI endemic to water birds is low pathology. No, so it means that it is not necessarily deadly to those water birds that are carrying it. Again, the highly pathogenic is a reference to poultry. The subclinical mild disease respiratory or GI tract is how this influenza attacks those birds and is transmitted by fecal oral. It means there's fecal material in the water. The birds are in the water. That's how the disease is passed around. The first major outbreak of the disease was in China at Qinghai in 2005. And here you'll see that in May, an outbreak of HPAI H5N1 was reported in Qinghai, and that is the large red dot in China. They were barheaded geese were the species that were mostly impacted, and almost 10% of that population was lost from this outbreak. From this location, researchers have been able to track the disease, the lineage, other reported cases in poultry and wild birds across Asia to Europe and Africa back to this outbreak. So that is really the start of that outbreak scenario. And why is this important to us? Flyways overlap, as we're seeing. There's some birds that are in one area, go east, some go west. Migrating waterfowl use these flyways and overlap with the area of the Qinghai Reserve that some birds come from. And you can see on this map that that Qinghai is there in China. These are the dark lines are pintails that are moving from that area. They combine in Siberia across Alaska. They can be mixed up with birds that come into North America in Alaska. That's why Alaska has been conducting surveillance since 1998, because of that. And most of those birds will come down the Pacific Flyway, and so the Pacific Flyway is more of a concern. However, a lot of those pintails, as you know, end up in our state and along our coast. So that is why we are a critical state for this surveillance. The eastern U.S. isn't as much of a concern because there's a fewer number of birds that interact with the European flyways. The other routes of introduction to North America are probably human-caused or human-brought. In September of 2005, there were 820 cases of eggs, 120 eggs each, discovered in a ship in California with no permits, and it was not listed on the manifest. So if this had been in those eggs and this poultry, it could have been entered that way. In October and November of 2005, there was 165,000 pounds of smuggled Asian poultry products that were intercepted on their way to this country. And recently, in the last few months, a shipment of chicken feet was smuggled into the United States from Thailand. They arrived in Connecticut marked jellyfish. So if these poultry products are contaminated and they arrive this way, are there people traveling worldwide today with carrying poultry products knowingly or unknowingly? That is a way that the flu could come to North America, not necessarily going to come from wild birds. There is a national pandemic influenza strategy that has been developed, and it's based on preparedness and communication, a surveillance and detection, which is ongoing now, and then response and containment, if it is found. This national strategy is being led by Homeland Security, with significant input and coordination with the United States Department of Agriculture and Department of Interior. And if a strain of this disease does mutate and develop into a pandemic strain, then this strategy will be implemented. But just the first two parts, the preparedness and communication, are there, and the surveillance is there. And I would like to, let me go one more slide here with, these are the death cases that have been reported in humans as a result of this. In many cases, in some of these Asian and African countries, people do live in close contact with poultry. They may keep a pet or a food duck or chicken in their house, and this close interaction, it can jump that species barrier, but it is very uncommon. So this is since 1998. This is all the human cases, and you can see that it's not always fatal. So now I'd like to ask Dave Morrison to come up and talk about our efforts at surveillance, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions. Dave?
Thank you, Mike. My name is Dave Morrison. I'm the waterfowl program leader for Texas Parks and Wildlife, and I have the dubious distinction of coordinating Texas Parks and Wildlife's role in the multi-agency efforts to detect highly pathogenic avian influenza. All states and various federal agencies have been working together to develop a national strategy, and this is going to be the responsibility of the 50 states, as well as select federal agencies to implement this program on the ground. Working in cooperation with these various government agencies, we've developed the Interagency Strategic Plan. And basically what that's doing is several things. One of the primary things is standardized protocols to include sampling, shipping, and diagnostics. And the reason this is so important, everything that we do in Texas will be the same in Alaska, will be the same in Maine, will be the same in Florida, so that the science behind this early detection and surveillance cannot be questioned. Also, as part of this national strategy, we've come up with early detection strategies. These include investigation of morbidity and mortality events, live bird surveillance, sport and subsistence hunting, sentinel surveillance, as well as environmental sampling. Now, all these have advantages and disadvantages, but what Texas is going to focus in with respect to our sampling will be the live bird as well as the sport and subsistence hunting. If morbidity and mortality events occur, then certainly we'll be there to take samples if necessary. During the course of development of this plan, states were assigned level 1, level 2, or level 3. You note that the red states are level 1, they're going to be required to collect 1,000 samples. The level 2 states are in blue, 750. Level 3 states in green will be required to collect 500 samples. If you look at that map, you see the West Coast is pretty important, simply because that's where the affinity of the birds coming through the Pacific Flyway tend to come from the Alaska region. So that's the reason why they're so important. You'll also notice that the Central Flyway, the northern tier of the Central Flyway, is also very important, with all those states being level 1. Again, the reason for that is it's a prime breeding area across this country. It's also a staging area for birds coming from northern Canada and Alaska. As you move further south, you'll see that Texas, Louisiana are the southern tier states that are level 1. The reason that's important is because we serve as the wintering terminus of these various flyways, and the bulk of the birds that winter in the United States typically occur in Texas and Louisiana. In the Central Flyway, there are 10 states, and we're going to have approximately $800,000 provided to these 10 states from the United States Department of Agriculture. USDA will also be providing approximately $270,000 in diagnostic funds to the approved labs to look at the 8,000 samples that we're going to be collecting. Many states have already started their sampling of their resident waterfowl. For example, Kansas is currently looking at resident game birds in urban areas. Nebraska is about to finish up its shorebird collections. Production states like North Dakota and South Dakota have already, as part of their normal banding operations, are also taking samples. So they're all well underway. Texas Parks and Wildlife Road, what are we going to do? Well, we have to collect 1,000 samples, as I said, either from hunter kills or live bird samples. We're going to be getting about $100,000 from USDA to fund this project, so hopefully we'll have no out-of-pocket of expenses. We're going to be looking at primary and secondary species. Primary species being the pintail, sandhill crane, pectoral sandpiper, long-billed dowitcher, and breasted sandpipers. Secondary species include just about every duck or geese that should fly into Texas, as well as a variety of shorebirds, including sandpipers, plovers, various gulls. So we're going to be looking at a lot of different things. Our sampling strategy is spatial and temporal. We're going to be looking through time and space. We're going to start next week in the Panhandle trying to collect some shorebirds as they start moving through the state. We'll also be looking at East Texas as they move through. We hope to conclude this by December 31st. We understand that we may run into problems, but we're going to shoot for that. We do have some latitude to go beyond December 31st, particularly for geese as they arrive sometimes later in January. And also, we'll be collecting blue and teal in March, trying to watch the back door, if you will, from Mexico and Central and South America. Our sample locations, we're going to start out in High Plains and Rolling Plains, again, because that's where the first birds are showing up. There's a high affinity for those birds coming in from Alaska. As our samples progress, we're going to start moving to the coastal areas, since by the time they get to the coastal areas, they've already mixed up with just about everything else. So we're going to be looking across the state in various times. I also point out that this is not a single agency endeavor. Wildlife Services, which is part of the USDA, also has similar responsibilities. They're going to have to collect 1,000 bird samples as well. Same species that Texas is going to be looking at, both primary and secondary. We're going to be working in conjunction with one another. But USDA Wildlife Services has also been tasked with collecting environmental samples. That'd be either fecal material or water samples from areas where birds may be concentrated. In summary, this is the largest surveillance effort ever undertaken of this kind. Across the state in federal jurisdiction, has support of government at all levels, and the process is going to be very transparent. And I emphasize this, very transparent, simply because if something should ever be found, they want to make sure the public is aware that we've done everything right and we've alerted them as quickly as possible. It's going to be expensive, time-consuming, and probably going to be a multi-year project. 1 year probably is not going to get it. No one is sure what we're going to find, but we feel it's necessary to keep the public aware of what's going on with this particular highly pathogenic avian influenza. With that, I'll shut up and take any questions you may have.
What, as part of the monitoring process, what time of year are we going to have any idea if there's been any communication through the that small part of overlap in the Arctic migratory waterfowl that will be coming down here in the fall?
Well, the pintails will start arriving next month. And as I said, Alaska's taken the brunt of this. They have to do all these sampling techniques. And they've collected probably about 20,000 samples during the course of the time they've been sampling. It takes about 2 to 4 days for the samples to be analyzed at the labs. Should something pop up that doesn't look right, then they have to send it to the National Veterinary Lab. And then they will take another 10 to 12 days, then we'll know something.
So the teal aren't in that part of the overlap, where there's overlap from
the blue wings. The blue wings that are coming through now, probably pretty safe, but we chose in Texas to look at those.
So it's only in that part you showed in the map where there's overlap with Asiatic migratory wildlife that then...
Actually, it could be anything, because those birds come out of Alaska into Saskatchewan. White fronts are a classic example. They come from the northern slope of Alaska. They end up in the Peace River of Alberta, then into Saskatchewan. Then they mix with everything else, and they're headed south. So it's not necessarily just that one little piece because of where they end up mixing with lots of other things.
But they're doing intensive surveillance in Alaska, where it's most likely to show up first, before we get it somewhere farther south. But as Dave said, they do mix throughout the flyway with other populations.
We briefed the Game Bird Advisory Board.
Yes, I gave a presentation to them a couple weeks ago on the furry issue.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have a quick question. I noticed, Mike, on one of your slides that you mentioned possessions and showed, you know, people getting off a boat or whatever. Is it possible to transmit this on an inanimate object?
No, but there are parts. If people are bringing in animal parts or products, that could have it on
them.
John?
Hey, how are you going to take your samples? Are you going to take your samples by trapping, or are you going to take your samples by hunter's bag, or how are you going to do that?
Ms. Parker, the samples are colloquial samples, and we plan on taking these either through hunter shot birds or birds that we actually collect. We're very concerned about live trapping birds, that if we should sample a bird, release it, 10 days later it comes back positive. The public relations nightmare of you turning loose something that had a highly pathogenic H5N1 is something I don't personally want to deal with. So we're going to try to focus our efforts on either hunter taken or birds that we actually collect.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I tell you what, that this is important work you're doing, and you don't get any attention until things go wrong. So I appreciate all you're doing to be in front of the problem. Next, item 13, action item, amendment statewide freshwater mussel and clam proclamation. Bill? Oh, I'm sorry, we had somebody on. Oh, we do on 13. Okay. Bill, go ahead. I'm an inexperienced vice chairman today.
Mr. Chairman, commissioners, I'm Bill Provine with Inland Fisheries. In the January commission meeting, I briefed you on the status of the freshwater mussel populations in Texas and the need for protection against overharvest. At that time, you instructed me to meet with the commercial musselers and work out a solution that protected the resources but didn't run people out of business. And I did that, and I think we've come up with a win-win solution. And that solution involves the establishment of a limited entry fishery and the modification of no harvest sanctuaries. In January, we talked about the ecological importance of freshwater mussels, how they're sensitive barometers of the environmental quality, how nationwide nearly 80% of mussel species are either threatened, endangered, or extinct. We talked about the economic importance. In the early part of the 20th century, mussel shells were mostly used for mother-of-pearl mussels. More recently, they were used for implant nuclei in the cultured pearl industry. Gem quality pearls are found in a couple of freshwater mussel species in Texas. Their shells are used in arts and craft industry, and the tissue is used for live bait. Our surveys have found in several streams and rivers in the states, the populations have been badly reduced or eliminated. Mussels grow very slowly. Some of them live 100 years, and they have complex life cycles. So the recovery of these animals could take quite a few years, even decades. The decline has been caused by many factors. Changing land use and overgrazing has caused scouring floods, reducing or deteriorating or even eliminating habitat in a lot of our streams and rivers. Droughts and pollution has killed all mussel species in certain sections of our rivers. Overharvest, although not a major problem in the decline of mussel species, it is a factor we need to consider when we talk about the well-being of this this resource. Currently, the Texas regulations allow essentially unlimited harvest of mussels over particular size groups. The demand has fluctuated quite a bit through the years. In the 1990s, we sold between 450 and 500 commercial mussel licenses in this state. The international demand was real high, and people came from a lot of states to Texas to harvest mussels. Demand has been fairly low in the last few years. Last year we only sold a total of 12 commercial musseling licenses, and no commercial buyer license were sold. Our concern is not what's going on right now. We don't really feel like these 12 people are causing a big problem, but we are concerned about what would happen to our resource, this degraded resource, if we sold 400 or 500 mussel licenses again. So to address this, we looked at a couple of options. We could decrease the bag limits, but to decrease the bag limits on 400 or 500 operators, we'd have to decrease them to such an extent that it would probably put these small businesses or these mufflers out of business. We also looked at limited entry. Similar to how some of our coastal fishes or species are managed. In this particular situation, limited entry would mean essentially grandfathering the existing license holders and not selling any new license. So our proposed changes would restrict the commercial license purchases to those who held license between September 1, '03 and May 1, '06. It would restrict recreational harvest to 25 pounds of whole mussels or 12 pounds of shells. Now there still is a recreational demand for pearls in several parts of Texas, and this would allow this activity to continue. It would require, our proposed changes would require a daily log. Now this is what's in it for us. When I spoke with you in January, we had really one mussel expert, Bob Howells, the author of the book that was distributed to you. Well, since then Bob has retired, so we don't really have much of a staff to collect information on mussels. So what we're going to do is to require the musclers, the commercial musclers, to report to us not only what they harvest and where they're harvesting it, but what they're seeing and where they're seeing it. So they're out there in a lot of different rivers and streams looking for new sources of mussels, looking for new mussel beds, and we could get them to keep us informed of where these beds are. Excuse me. These proposed changes would also prohibit the take of mussels in 16 sanctuaries. Now this is a reduction from the previous rule. We used to have 21 sanctuaries. Some were deleted because the environment or the habitat was deteriorated so much there weren't any mussels and we weren't protecting anything. Some were added because we found new areas of endangered or rare species. So what the staff is recommending is that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the repeal of 57-157 and accept the new 57-157 concerning mussels and clams with changes as published in the June 9th, 2006 issue of the Texas Register. Be happy to answer questions at this time.
You have the support of the industry? I mean, you said you've worked something out to the consensual plan?
Yes. Yeah,
thank you for doing that. Could you show us the map of the restricted areas and explain how you selected those?
Well, to begin with, we had limited knowledge of the mussels in Texas. So we tried to, some of them were arbitrary, and those really the ones that were changed, the ones that we missed. We knew of some mussel populations that were kind of in trouble, and we knew where certain rare species were. So we included those in our first 21, but some of those were arbitrarily chosen, and we just chose the wrong rivers. Once we got the manpower to get out there and look more closely, we decided to change those sanctuaries. They weren't returning.
Bill, we have a few people signed up to testify on this issue. If you'll stand by, maybe answer some other questions that the commissioners have after we hear that testimony. Thanks for your work on this. Stand by here, and we will call Total price? Mr. Price and Mr. Weaver, be ready.
Hey, y'all doing? I just want to get up here and thank you guys for all of your time and your effort on this and working with Bill over here and tell you I really appreciate it. And have y'all got any questions for us? You know?
Well, I tell you what, I appreciate you working with the staff. It sounds like you've come up with a proposal that you can live with and help us conserve the resource and you continue to do your work. Any questions you have? Thank you for taking the time to work with us. That doesn't always work that way, and I appreciate you
taking the time. Well, I thank y'all a lot for your time and your efforts, and we're looking forward to working with Bill and the Wildlife Department, letting them know what we can, you know. And like he said, we're out there quite a bit, and we've got a pretty good idea of what's out there. And like I said, we're looking forward to working with him, so sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Nobody knows more about the resource than the guy closest to it. Thanks. Next, I have Mr. Scott Weaver.
Hello. Pretty much ditto is what Tony said. I really appreciate Bill for all the effort he put in, and I know you guys are really underappreciated, not just by us commercial guys, but all sportsmen. And thanks again.
Thanks for your work. Thank you very much, Mr. Weaver. Any other questions for Bill or from the commission? Is there a motion on this item?
No.
Moved by Holt, second by Friedkin. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Thank you, Bill. Next up, item 14, we have a briefing item on federal and state management of Red Snapper. Management by lawsuit.
Well, that could be the description. We could just stop there. I'm here for the record. My name is Robin Rikers, and I'm Director of Science and Policy with Coastal Fisheries Division. And as indicated, I'm here to present to you a briefing on the federal and state cooperative management regarding the red snapper fishery. Just kind of catch everyone up. Our federal partners in this basically starts at the level of the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council, which is one of the eight regional councils that was formed by the Magnuson Act in 1976. The Magnuson Act at that point governed how those councils would behave, basically. That body is made up of 17 members, 11 members who are nominated by their governors in the Gulf states and appointed by the Secretary of Commerce. In addition to those 11 members, there's five members that represent the coastal aquatic resources, wildlife and fisheries in our case, coastal fisheries group, one member from each of the five states, and then the regional director from the National Marine Fisheries Service out of St. Pete makes up the full 17-member body. That body basically serves in an advisory role to the National Marine Fisheries Service, who, of course, is in the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration. Currently, we're under the guidelines of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which was reauthorized in 1996, and there's current draft language on the Hill today that will reauthorize this once again. And they kind of thought it was going to go through this fall, but it's looking more like spring, if at all, right now. So basically what the Magnuson-Stevens Act does is set up guidelines for the Council of the National Marine Fisheries Service to create fishery management plans. And within that is to basically set sustainable levels of harvest on fisheries where we can have that kind of fishery. What it does is require us to set overfishing rates, which is the level of fishing that can accrue for a particular given year where you would not eventually lead the stock to an overfished status or overfished level. And then we set that base level. And so anytime we have an overfishing rate, we're required to take certain actions. And anytime you hit an overfished level, you're basically required by law to take certain actions. What we typically do in those cases is set a total allowable catch, which I'll refer to as TAC later on in this presentation, and we use the traditional measures we use here, size and bag limits, area seasonal closures, trip limits, and gear restrictions to try to maintain the catch within that total allowable catch for the year. In the red snapper fishery today, that TAC is allocated and has been allocated since basically the early 1990s when the first reef fish management plan went into effect.
it's allocated 51% to the commercial fishery and 49% to the recreational fishery. Our history of our tax and our tax setting basically are as follows. In March of 1991, the tax was set at 4 million pounds. After revision of the models and the assessment, it was revised upwards to 6 million pounds in 1993. It stayed in that ballpark until 1996, when it was increased to 9.12 million pounds, and we've been there ever since. Now, in 2000, there was a lot of discussion about lowering the tax when a new assessment was done. And in 2006, following the assessment that was given to us in 2005, there's a considerable amount of discussion regarding where the tack will be set. It looks as if we're going to be in a range somewhere from 5 to 7 million pounds. Under a 9.12 million pound tack, which is where we're at today, we have about 194-day recreational season. If we go to a 7 million pound tack, you're going to be looking at a reduction from anywhere from 76 to 94 days. And if you go to a 5 million pound tack, you're going to be looking at a reduction in days somewhere in the order of 60 to 103 days, depending on the bag and size limit combinations you choose. In the commercial fisheries management, I just wanted to note that we're really transitioning at this point. We've been acting under a tack, a total allowable catch, where it's basically established for the year. It's divided two-thirds into a spring sub-quota, if you will, and a one-third in a fall sub-quota. And then when they reach those sub-quotas, basically the season stops no matter how many days they fish. It was basically a derby-type environment that would open the season for the first 10 days of each month. People would fish as hard as they could given the trip limits they had, come to the shore, they would kind of do the accounting and figure out where they were, and they'd go back out if they had any tack left for that 10-day window. And that went on until for months until, you know, their side of the quota was reached, their sub-quota in those two seasons. We're transitioning to an individual fishery quota, or individual transferable quota system. It's been passed out of council for over a year now, or pretty close to a year. It's called Reef Fish Amendment 26. The Secretary of Commerce is out for comment on that right now, and those comments are being accepted until October 1st of 2006. Another transition in the commercial fishery is that we are going to go towards vessel monitoring systems. Those will be required by the end of this year for every reef fish permitted vessel, including red snappers. That basically is a real-time monitoring of where those boats are and where they're fishing at any given time when they're on the water, assuming the equipment's working correctly. In the recreational fisheries management side, in federal waters, we are currently at a 4-fish bag limit, a 16-inch minimum size limit, and our season runs from April 21st to October 31st, or really November 1st at midnight. That equates to that 194-day season that I mentioned just before. In Texas waters, we've maintained a 4-fish bag limit, a 15-inch minimum size limit, and we have no closed season inside our waters at this point in time. The reason we've stated a 15-inch minimum size limit, many people have asked this question. One of the reasons is the commercial side is at a 15-inch minimum size limit, and we wanted to maintain that consistency between the commercial size limit and the recreational size limit so that there's not conflict over that, people fishing on a size limit that's smaller and not getting into the recreational fishery. When you look at kind of the where we stand today with regards to the red snapper stock assessment, as I indicated, the previous assessment was in 2000. The ideal is that you get a benchmark assessment every 5 years. So we were presented a new assessment in the fall of 2005. The Gulf Council started working on a joint reef fish shrimp amendment plan. It's Reef Fish Amendment 27 and Shrimp Amendment 14. And I was really here and anticipated the next slide would be showing you where public hearings were going to be held in the fall. But based on action in Baton Rouge of last week, basically the council passed a motion on a 10-5 vote that stalled all action on this amendment until January 1 of 2007. Let me at least try to give you my opinion of how I heard the arguments for delay. The first and probably greatest argument, or one of the greatest arguments by many of the people, is that the assessment was based on the 2001-2003 time period. And when you factor in Katrina and Rita impacts into that, the world has changed greatly in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, and many people just believe that the assessment is no longer an assessment that depicts the reality on the ground in those states as far as the commercial effort that's going on and the recreational effort. The other thing that has happened since that time is there's been a National Research Council review of the Marine Recreational Fisheries Statistical Survey. That's the survey that basically does their recreational statistics. It runs from Louisiana all the way through Florida, and many other states use it. Here in Texas, we do not use that survey. We aborted that survey a long time ago. But basically, the Research Council found many flaws in the survey. It's not necessarily in the report, but one of the authors of the report in presentation to fishing interests basically called it fatally flawed. So there's a lot of concerns about the data coming out of that and the estimations coming out of that and how that works into the assessment. And then the last issue would be the issues regarding equity issues when we talk about rebuilding this fishery. Many people in the directed fishery and commercial and recreational directed fishery feel like they've taken the brunt of this rebuilding plan. They've reduced tax, they've reduced bag limits, and reduced their seasons, and at the same time, the effort hasn't been made on the bycatch side of this equation to basically do their part. And they felt like in the current amendment, more and more of the items in Shrimp 14 were being taken out of the amendment, and they didn't want to go forward unless those were in the amendment. Where that leaves us today is National Marine Fisheries Service could, for the year 2000, use an interim rule or an emergency rule to go ahead and set the tack. It could be set, it could remain status quo at 9.12, or it could be set at any of the options that were in the previous amendment, ranging, I would guess, from 5 to 7 million pounds. Then, as we move forward for subsequent years, National Marine Fisheries Service and Secretary of Commerce could choose to do a secretarial amendment, which would basically remove the Gulf Council from the process. And then lastly, the option is to resume the council amendment either at a November meeting or a January meeting. And we certainly will resume it in January if nothing else takes place, but we could even resume it at our November meeting. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time.
I understand the reason for the keeping the 15-inch, the commercial, and the recreational the same, so there's no confusion between the two and for law enforcement purposes. But why the difference between the 15 and the 16 when you get to the 9 mile mark?
Oh, they moved the recreational. They were at 15, and the in federal waters they moved it up to 16 inches some time back. The idea was that they felt like the yield per recruit was higher at 16 inches, basically creating more biomass. Subsequent to that, quite frankly, we found that the discards are so much greater in federal levels. At the federal level, we're really talking about now a reduction in size limits, possibly coming back down to 13 inches. But we stayed at that 15 inches because that's where the commercial was at that time when they took the action to go to 16.
Okay, so what you're saying is the reason for going to 16 on the federal proved to be incorrect?
That's basically correct, yes.
Phil? I sure like the ITQ system. I appreciate you all headed that way. Is there any risk that we won't go that way with this one? Or are we pretty comfortable that's the way it's going to go?
There's been a lot of people more recently after this current assessment came out, I think now coming to the table and questioning the IFQs, not questioning from a management standpoint, but more questioning how law enforcement could really enforce that. In reality, there's going to be more checks and balances in enforcement than there would have been under the old system. So I believe that we're moving ahead and that it will be passed, and certainly every indication we've gotten from Washington is that it will be going through.
Okay.
And it is ITQ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that ITQ system under, could that change due to the litigation, the pending litigation, Red Snapper?
The pending litigation that I'm aware of does not, it's not questioning the ITQ system. It's questioning whether or not there's been appropriate bycatch reduction elements put into the plans.
Okay.
I hope we'll look for every opportunity to move that direction with our fisheries management. It seems to me it's a far superior system.
Yeah, I agree with Commissioner Montgomery. It's consistent with what we've been doing on the inshore, and it's certainly consistent philosophically with what we do onshore with wildlife, which is to give every incentive and management flexibility to the people that are moving the ball.
Yeah.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
Adam? don't believe we had anybody signed up on Red Snapper, number 14. Didn't miss anyone there. We will go to item 15, action item amendments to the harmful, potentially harmful exotic fish, shellfish, and aquatic plants regulations. Okay.
Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Joe DeGray with the Inland Fisheries Division. The Commission has established rules to regulate the importation, possession, sale, and placement into waters of the state any harmful or potentially harmful exotic fish, shellfish, or aquatic plant. Staff is proposing amendments to these rules which will provide additional protection to our native aquatic species and provide consistency and clarification in the provisions of the rules. Staff is proposing adding two exotic Chinese carp to the prohibited fish list. These carp have the potential to cause negative ecological impacts if accidentally raised in the state waters. Round gobies have invaded the Great Lakes, causing ecological damage to native fish species. Therefore, staff proposes adding round gobies to our prohibited fish list. Chinese perches have been added because of their cold tolerance and their potential to compete with our native largemouth and smallmouth bass. The Asian and European temperate basses are ecological counterparts of our native striped and white basses and have the potential to be major competitors with our native species. Staff is proposing prohibiting all species of temperate basses except striped bass, white bass, yellow bass, and hybrids between the three. Staff is proposing the following changes to the prohibited fish list. The prohibition on crayfish has been expanded to include all southern hemisphere crayfishes. Some species of Australian crayfish would represent a major ecological threat if released in Texas. Therefore, it is prudent to restrict them now before they become prevalent in the aquaculture or pet industries. Additionally, the prohibition of Apa snails and giant ram's horn snails has been expanded to include all but one species, which is currently popular in the pet industry. To maintain consistency with the USDA and the Texas Department of Agriculture regulations, eight species of plants have been added to the prohibited plant list. Finally, water spinach has been added to the list of exotic species that are permitted to culture in Texas. Water spinach has been cultured for over 20 years in the Houston area. Extensive habitat surveys by staff biologists revealed no evidence of water spinach in public waters. Therefore, staff recommends that current culture facilities be allowed to continue operating under a permit from the department. The proposed amendments were published in the Texas Register and received negative comments from members of academia, the aquaculture, and pet industries. One comment was received in support of the proposed rules, and two comments were neutral. The major concern from the aquaculture industry and academia was the economic effect the prohibition would have on small businesses which currently culture and sell Australian red claw in Texas. In response to comments from the aquaculture industry, staff is proposing to add an exception to subsection 57.113D to allow possession, propagation, sale, and transport of Australian red claw crayfish, provided applicants meet the requirements to obtain an exotic species permit. Retail or wholesale fish dealers may possess live specimens of Australian red claw crayfish, but may only sell or deliver specimens that are dead and packaged on ice or frozen. Staff surveys of other states indicated that nine states either totally ban or have some sort of restriction on species in the family Parastaceae. Staff contacted other Gulf states and found that Florida only allows culture of red claws with a permit. All other states, with the exception of Alabama, strongly discourage the use of red claw. Alabama has promoted the use of red claw in their ag programs in the past, but has now taken a more cautious approach. Staff recommends that the Commission adopt the proposed rule amendments, suggested modifications, and text clarifications to the harmful or potential harmful exotic fish, shellfish, and aquatic plant rules. And I'll be happy to answer any questions. Yes.
We do have someone signed up to testify on this, so if you'll stand by for any questions that that may generate, I appreciate it. Noel Coward?
Yes, sir.
Texas Aquatics Association, is that right? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, my name is Noel Coward. I'm the president of Texas Aquaponics
a Texas limited liability corporation in Maypearl, Ellis County, Texas. I'm also the president of the Texas Red Claw Association. I've been studying and raising a species of Texas of parasitic crayfish for 7 years, particularly the Australian Red Claw, or Chirox quadricurantis. And I'm informed that I have only 3 minutes, so here we go. I represent all the Red Claw crayfish farmers in Texas. Red Claw have been farmed and sold in for food and aquariums to aquarium stores since 1991 in Texas. I learned of your proposed rulemaking, and I called the Department of Wildlife. I talked to Bill Robinson, who told me they were just tired of answering the phone, and so they were going to try to create a white list for exotic species. As a seventh-generation Texan, it sounds like a lazy bureaucracy to me. Yesterday, your employee, Raynell Silcox, allowed me to view the responses the department has taken. They have decided to assume the minority position to prove their proposal. I have called several farmers and primary researchers in Australia last night. They never heard of the person who had sent the main derogatory email and could only determine that it was some flake on the Internet that was dispersing spurious data, of which there are many. I hope we don't want to base Texas regulations on unverified sources on the Internet. Your commission has ignored the majority of responses, and at least one grower in Victoria, Texas, has been growing them for the pet industry market for 3 years, and the corporate giant Petco, who I have been in Petco's and seen Australian Red Claw. The commission has ignored also the reports from Texas A&M, and who Governor Perry purports to support, whose studies on Australian Red Claw were funded by taxpayer money. By doing so, they have placed the research of Texas A&M as fraudulent and fake. I'm sure that the Texas A&M Gazette will be interested to know that. This rulemaking action will destroy a possible multi-million dollar industry that is growing in Texas. They've never harmed anything in the 15 years of their existence here and cannot even create a feral population in their own Australian country after 20 years. I believe this rulemaking was not afforded any right of due process before being stripped of its right of commerce. I've talked to our attorney last night, and if passage happens as currently proposed, we will be filing a lawsuit in federal court regardless of the lack of due process. My small company alone has gone from $120 a month to $3,000 plus a month in sales in the first 5 months of 2006, and I've spent $10,000 in importation costs and fees this year alone. We have $20,000 in orders to pet stores that are on hold right now because of this legislation. We want Chirox quadricurantis exempted from this rulemaking, as they are in Alabama and other southern states. That leaves you 163 other species that are prohibited. If there are any questions, I'm out of time.
Thank you, sir. Bill, I have a couple questions too for you and Jody. I guess explain again, Jody, the threat from the Australian Red Claw.
Well, anytime you have any kind of exotic species that's accidentally introduced, you have a threat. I mean, we're looking at problems from hydrilla, from salvinia, from tilapia, and you never know how long it's going to take for adverse effects to happen. Tilapia took 10 years before they started showing up in all our waters. It's not our purpose to put anybody out of business. Our mandate is to protect the environment, and so we have to err on the side of caution whenever we do that.
Protect that native habitat.
And you look at Maryland now with the snakehead issue up there, and
that's a very good example of the snakehead. But Phil, you want to add something?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, I'm Phil DeRosa, the Director of Inland Fisheries. This whole harmful, potentially harmful list is a lot of concern to us. The way the law reads now, if something is not on that list, if we don't put it on that list, it's legal in Texas. So what that puts us in most cases is behind the curve. By the time we find out something is in Texas and it can be a detriment to the environment of some of our native species, that horse is usually out of the barn. And we look at what's happened with species like hydrilla and giant salvinia, the way the world is now with the mass transportation, people moving around, we're getting a lot of different things in Texas. It would be preferable to us
that we had a list of accepted species in Texas. And anybody who wished to bring in something that wasn't on that list would have to provide us with the risk analysis. But the way it is now, we have to prove that it's a detriment. And we will try to err on the conservative side because we've got too many cases of things that were supposedly going to be great for the state and didn't turn out that way.
And those that you mentioned, those exotics that have become had a resource impact on our native habitat, have come from the pet and aquarium trade.
Absolutely.
Not exclusively, but...
No, and I mean, and they didn't mean any harm at the time.
Right.
But we have no way of knowing, and when we find out something is here, and we generally try to look at it, and if it's of concern, then we're going to bring it up and try to get it on that list before the industry really grows to the point where we hurt a lot of people having to put it on there.
Commissioner?
I'm for you on being cautious on exotics. I know I've always argued for more opportunity, but on this one, I think the externalities of exotics going loose far exceed the benefits of being liberal, so appreciate you all being conservative on this one.
Thank you.
Commissioner Parker?
Phil, did somebody mention tilapia a moment ago? Jody, what did you say about it?
I just said that sometimes...
Come on, Jody.
Come on up, Jody.
Jody Gray, Inland Fisheries. I just said that sometimes it takes a while when they were introduced, 10 years before they start showing up. So say some of these red claw get loose, it may be 10 years before we start seeing negative impacts. That's the point I was making.
But tilapia is not on the list.
Yes, it is.
It is?
Yes.
Tilapia is...
Tilapia, yeah. They're all on the list. They can have them with a permit from the department, and that's what we were proposing here, was to allow this continued culture of red claw with an exotic species permit. And you can do that with tilapia, certain species of tilapia.
Okay.
Mr. Parker, there are numerous species of tilapia. Some of them are more cold tolerant than others. The ones that are the most cold tolerant are on this list.
Thank you. Any other questions for Phil or Jody on this issue? Do I have a motion? Motion by Commissioner Holt, second by Commissioner Montgomery. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none. Motion passes. Item 16. briefing item on the Indian Fish Hatchery Program. Todd?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, did I miss one? Item 15.
I thought I was 16.
No, 5.
That's all right.
He's anxious.
That's good. That lets you go first if you like.
Glad to see your enthusiasm there, man.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, my name is Todd Engling, and I serve as the Chief of Hatcheries for Inland Fisheries Division. Today I will provide you with an update of the Department's Freshwater Hatchery Program, including current production levels and status of recent facility improvements and anticipated future projects. Since the late 1800s, hatchery production has been used as a tool in fisheries management, and today more than 425 state fish hatcheries and 68 federal fish hatcheries are employed by conservation agencies throughout the United States to assist fishery managers and sport fish populations and in restoring threatened and endangered species. Since 1925, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, or its predecessor agency, has operated 17 freshwater fish hatcheries in support of fishery management objectives across the state. Today, we operate 5 facilities. The Dundee Fish Hatchery, located near Wichita Falls, the Possum Kingdom Fish Hatchery, located near Mineral Wells, the Texas Freshwater Fishery Center in Athens, the Jasper Fish Hatchery in Jasper, and the Eddywood Fish Hatchery in San Marcos. The Inland Fisheries Hatchery Program has a proud history of production and excellence. To date, more than 779 million fish of 40 different species or subspecies have been stocked in public water, including 7 million adult-sized fish, 327 million fingerling-sized fish, and 445 million fry. Currently, 10 species are routinely cultured in our facilities and are acquired from commercial producers and stocked each year, including largemouth bass, striped bass, and hybrid striped bass, channel catfish, blue catfish, smallmouth bass, sawgrass, various sunfish species, walleye, rainbow trout, which are acquired from a commercial producer out of Missouri, and red drum, which are produced in our coastal facilities, are acquired from a commercial producer when available. On average, 14 to 15 million finlings are stocked in more than 400 water bodies in Texas each year as part of the statewide management efforts. To date, in 2006, approximately 12 million finlings have been stocked in 370 locations. To accomplish this, Hatcher staff make more than 600 stocking trips and drive over a quarter million miles distributing fish in each year in Texas throughout the state. On average, the majority of fish stocked are largemouth bass, or striped bass, or the hybrid striped bass, which comprise approximately 74% of the total finlings stocked annually. Also on average, demand for these two important species currently exceeds production capacity by about 6 to 7 million finlings. This is primarily due to the result of limited production space in our hatcheries. An essential component in meeting the production demands and maximizing hatchery operating flexibility and efficiency are continuing facility improvements. With the exception of the Texas Freshwater Fishery Center, most of the facilities that are currently in operation were constructed prior to 1950. During the mid-80s and early 90s, renovation efforts were started with the Eddywood Fish Hatchery in San Marcos and then the Dundee Fish Hatchery in Wichita Falls. Of course, the Texas Freshwater Fishery Center was constructed in 1999, and most recently, renovations were accomplished to Possum Kingdom Fish Hatchery. The Possum Kingdom Fish Hatchery, which was constructed in 1950, has been undergoing renovations since 2001. As part of those renovations, a total replacement of water distribution and drainage systems was accomplished. Construction of maintenance and equipment storage facilities was accomplished. Construction of intensive spawning and rearing facility was done, and also construction of administrative and laboratory and staff support building was constructed. The Eddywood Fish Hatchery in San Marcos was originally constructed in 1949 and was completely renovated in 1989. In 2005, additional repairs were made to water intake structures in the San Marcos River, as well as total replacement of production pond liners. In 2006, additional renovations were scheduled for the storage reservoir, which is the large 9.5-acre rip pond, which is shown in the photograph, which will receive, again, new pond liners and also renovation of its levees. The Dundee Fish Hatchery, which was originally constructed in 1927 and is our largest production facility currently in the state, was partially renovated in 1994. Repairs that are scheduled for it in 2006 include partial replacement of its pond liners. As you are aware, a site was selected to replace the Jasper Fish Hatchery in East Texas below the Sam Rayburn Reservoir in Jasper County. Currently, design efforts on that are approximately 30% complete, and construction is scheduled to begin sometime next summer. Current plans to develop the site include 60 to 70 acres of production ponds, a 30,000 square foot production building, and about 8,000 square feet of administrative and office space, including staff support areas. In the near future, funds generated with the freshwater fishing stamp will ensure that facility repairs and improvements can be accomplished. Facility improvements will target not only scheduled maintenance and repairs, but will look to incorporate technologies to address or mitigate issues associated with toxic golden algae, water allocation and conservation, and opportunities to increase facility operating flexibility and efficiencies. Some of the projects include additional improvements at the Possum Kingdom Fish Hatchery, such as incorporating water treatment technologies to deal with the toxic golden algae. Also, looking at opportunities to expand the facility to meet our production demands. Also looking at the Dundee Fish Hatchery, incorporating again water treatment technologies to control the toxic golden algae. Also to construct an intensive spawning facility and to renovate the existing water supply system. Other improvements include construction at the Texas Freshwater Fishery Center to develop a storage reservoir, which would offer staff an opportunity to better control the water flow to the facility and grant them a little greater operating flexibility. Also, looking at expansion of the fish health and fish genetics laboratory in San Marcos at the U.S. Fish Hatchery, and then also to address statewide maintenance and repair needs. Texas lakes and rivers continue to provide a quality fishing experience for Texas anglers. For decades, hatchery stockings have played a significant role in management efforts by providing quality fish for stocking, not only in large impoundments, but also in small urban impoundments. Continued support and funding to improve and maintain hatchery facilities is vital to sustaining production levels and continuing to support fisheries management efforts throughout the state. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Now, we have one person signed up on this, but do you know how much that bass weighed?
Excuse me? That was one of the lumpers that was caught last year out of Lake Casablanca and Laredo. So
14 pounds or something? We have one person signed up, Will Kirkpatrick.
My name is Will Kirkpatrick. I live on Rayburn. Yesterday when I talked after the meeting, I was asked about the figures I had spoke with. There were some problems. The figures we had were incorrectly overestimated. The dollar value was $6 million. It was overestimated for the Jasper location. And it's actually going to cost Texans about $3 million extra from what it would have at the other location. That's what I had to say.
Thank you very much.
If you got any questions at any time, we can answer them.
Thank you. This is not an action item. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Item number 17. Vernon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. For the record, my name is Vernon Bevel, and I'm Program Director for Migratory Small Game and Habitat Assessment. I'd like to present to you today the late season regulation proposal for the waterfowl season. There's a couple of fairly major changes that I'll bring to your attention on this slide, the Hunter Choice Bag and the issue we began to deal with the light goose conservation order. For the High Plain Mallard Management Unit, the season and bag limits are basically unchanged from last year, except the bag has dropped from 6 to 5 that I will talk about on the Hunter's Choice. But we have 89 days available to us that we have broken out into a youth hunt, a short split, and then the longer split. The north and south zone, we're basically doing the same season setup as we did a year ago. Seemed to work well, and under these longer seasons, having similar seasons within the north and south zone seemed to work out okay. If we get to shorter season options, we'll have to reconsider that makeup. For our bag limit and opportunities there, we are again under some species restrictions, two scop, two wood ducks, two redheads, and then under the hunter choice bag, one of any of an aggregate group, hen mallard, pintail, canvasback, a mottled duck, a dusky duck is what we're actually calling it. That includes mottled duck, black duck, and Mexican light duck. All other species in the bag, five birds are allowable. We have our merganser bag. This year we add one hooded merganser to that bag option, coot similar to last year. Let me go over Hunter Choice with you. I've briefed you on this several times. We've had some extensive feedback from sportsmen on it. But the Hunter Choice bag is an effort to try to get away from the season within a season for particularly pintail and canvasback. There are other species that may be coming online that don't seem to be able to handle the heavy harvest.
like these two species, and we've been looking for an opportunity to maintain the long season for the species that don't have a problem with the heavier harvest, but still protect the resource of those species that seem to be having problems. And that's basically, as you can read in this slide, the aim of the Hunter Choice bag. And the Hunter Choice species, to give you a kind of a brief overview, the species up at the upper left of your slide are the species that hunters can kill five of every day. The species on the upper right are those species that are restricted to no more than two each per day. And then the group at the bottom are the species in the Hunter Choice, of which the hunter can take any one of in a given day. For the eastern goose zone, we basically are similar to last year. That's the breakout for the eastern goose zone. Western goose zone, the same. We came to you back in the spring with some information we had received from a public hearing sponsored by the Fish and Wildlife Service that suggested that the light goose conservation order should be ended in Texas. So we proposed that so we could get it on the public agenda for discussion among our hunters to be sure we were hearing the hunting interest correctly. As a result, we found out that a lot of folks didn't want the light goose order to be ended, so we will be taking that off the table. Sandhill crane seasons are broken out in three zones. To basically, the zone of seasons allow the hoopers to come through the various parts of Texas on their route to the Aransas Refuge. We had 37 comments in support of the Hunter Choice bag. We had 35 comments that were opposed to our proposals. Basically, most of them centered on Hunter's Choice. Some of them dealt with different issues. And as you can see, regarding the light goose conservation order, when we put it out on the public table, we had a far greater group of people who favored the continuance of Hunter's Choice than us eliminating it. And this slide represents the recommendation that you will be acting on in a few minutes. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer any questions.
I've got one. Can you update us just briefly on the current status of the nesting habitat in Canada for the snow geese?
If I remember rightly, we get so many reports in a given time frame, but snow geese look pretty good across a good many of their nesting areas, and apparently they had an early spring in some areas, and so geese in general look good this year, and many of the goose populations are well above the population management plan goal, because we're still trying to get a handle on snow geese. Harvest is not going to get us there probably, but
the extended snow geese season has not affected the populations in any way?
The extended snow goose season probably has resulted in some impact in certain areas. We don't see as many snow geese getting to the Texas coast as we once did. And so from that standpoint, we have probably had some impact. Up in your part of the state, we've continued to see a growth in snow goose numbers. And of course, 15 years ago, there were hardly any snow geese in the panhandle. So some of the wintering populations of snow geese are in different locations than they used to be.
But the actual habitat destruction in Canada, is it?
Continues.
It's continuing.
It continues.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bernie. Any other questions for Vernon? Have a motion? Moved by Parker, second by Hope. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any none? Motion passes. Thank you, Vernon. Oh, I'm sorry. Ran right over. Two comments. I'm sorry. Kirby Brown. You're going to rescind your motion? Kirby's going to change your mind. All right.
No, I'll watch this.
We've done it before. All right.
Kirby Brown, Executive Vice President of Texas Wildlife Association, and we support the staff proposal. We have a lot of support for the Hunter's Choice bag limit to avoid the season within a season, and we continue to support the light goose conservation order because there are continued habitat impacts in the Arctic. So that's all we wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Kirby. Mr. Gilman?
Speaking for Texas Animals, which is an animal rights organization on the internet, I'd like to make a request, the same request I made last year, to cancel the dove hunting. And the reason why is because the dove is the international symbol of peace, and we certainly don't want to be shooting that down. The other aspect of it is, which I don't think you consider, is that many states do not even allow dove hunting at all, even though they do have them. And as a loyal foot soldier, I followed my national leaders, and President Bush doesn't shoot doves. He shoots killdees. And even Vice President Cheney doesn't shoot doves. He shoots lawyers.
He's pretty good, too.
All right.
Any other questions? Comments? I like that. Can we get our lawyer season next time there, Vernon? You can get to work on that.
All right.
Mr. Parker?
So moved.
Moved. Second. By Holmes. All in favor, aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, motion passes. Get to work, Brian. Be dismissed. Go get the lawyer season started. Next up is item 18, oil and gas lease nomination.
I hope my lifetime license is applied.
That was the best one yet.
For the record, my name is Corky Coleman. I'm with the Land Conservation Program, Parks and Wildlife. This is a lease nomination. The authority for leasing minerals for Texas Parks and Wildlife lands lies with the General Land Office, and traditionally they have accepted the recommendations of this board. This is a nomination at Lockhart State Park in Caldwell County. It is for the entire park, 264 acres. It's the usual conditions, no surface occupancy, $150 an acre lease minimum, 25% royalty, $10 delay rental, and 3-year term. Staff recommendation is you pass the motion before you.
Thank you, Corky. It's a good piece of work. Motion, Bivens, and second by Friedkin. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Thanks, Corky. Next up, item 19, land donation, Brown County. Corky, you're still up.
This is a mineral and land donation at the Muse Wildlife Management Area. The Muse Estate has donated the mineral rights and any properties that they may have left at the area that weren't donated in the 1998 donation to TPWD. Staff recommends you pass the motion before you.
Well, and thanks to the donor. That's very kind. Pass on our thanks there. Any motion here? Motion by Friedkin. Second. Second by Holmes. All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Thank you very much, Corky, for getting that work done. Item 20, action item, land donation, another land donation. Ted?
Good afternoon, Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item pertains to the acceptance of the donation of some in-holdings at Black Gap Wildlife Management Area, part of our ongoing strategy to tie up as much of that country in conservation as possible. These tracts are being acquired by the Texas Bighorn Society and offered to us in order to plug some small remaining inholdings at the wildlife management area. You've heard this. This is second reading. We can. You'll see a commission action item here to accept these tracts. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have about the transaction. We also have David Wenzel, the president of TBS here, traveled all the way out here in case you have any questions for TBS regarding what they're trying to accomplish for us in terms of bighorn sheep management at the area.
Thank you, Ted. David, would you like to come up and tell us what you're doing? No? Well, I want to thank you. And other commissioners want to thank the Texas Bighorn Society for all you do. That's typical. You guys will just do the work and leave the talking to somebody else. It's a great organization of hunters and conservationists, and we really appreciate this donation. Any questions for Ted? Any questions from the commissioners for the Texas Bighorn Society? We do have one person signed up to testify on item 20, so stand by, Ted. We need to answer some questions. Marilyn Shackelford, please.
Thank you for putting these items on the last of the list, that maybe you'll remember them. I'm Marilyn Shackelford of Marathon, Texas, Brewster County. And I was born and raised in Brewster County, and my family goes back seven generations there. I've taught school in the Big Bend area for 40 years, and I am a private landowner, and my husband's land borders Black Gap Game Preserve. I'm here to oppose the acceptance of the 1,380 acres of land donated by the Bighorn Sheep Association, as well as to oppose the conservation easement of the 9,470 acres, better known as the Adams Ranch, now owned by CMEX. I am not a negative person, but what I see happening concerns me greatly. The conservation easement on the 9,470 acres, and is it all right if I speak to that?
That's another
item.
Yes, ma'am. Why don't we just talk about the Texas Bighorn Society's donation to... which is item 20.
Okay.
And we'll go to 21.
Okay. I had it all kind of together here.
That's fine. Take time. I just think that for the record, it's important. Those are two separate items on the agenda.
That's a conservation easement. Let me just get this separated.
As I understand it, Ted, this is not a donation of an easement. This is a donation of the land as to item 20, correct?
Correct.
Right. So
this is land.
If you'd restrict your comments to the Texas Bighorn Society's donation, please.
All right. Texas Bighorn Association donating the 1,380 acres, we're very familiar with that property in small tracts. And noticed that they have not really had got that 1,380 acres intact yet. They're still contacting landowners, and Mr. Wenzel can speak to that. But when you take this acreage, you've got me a little bit thrown now, instead of accepting the land which is given by the Bighorn Sheep Association, we need to be more concerned with what Texas Parks and Wildlife is having to do with the Bighorn Sheep Association. Sure, they're giving it to you. They're buying the money and they're paying for the land. But who is running that land? Who's taking care of it? Who's taking care of the Bighorn Sheep that were brought in and dumped on the Black Gap? And then somebody has to take care of those sheep. That's Texas Parks and Wildlife employees that are doing that. And not only are you paying an employee to do that, or employees, they're using pickups, they're using gasoline, and I understand that there's a shortage of money in the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, as there are in all the other departments. They have to use bulldozers, they have water guzzlers they need to check. How often are those water guzzlers checked? We, as a ranch owner, we had about 17 guzzlers on our land. We don't check those once a month, once every 3 months, or once every 6 months. We check those every single week. If water's not in, we haul water to them if it doesn't rain. So my concern is, where is the money's coming from to take care of these bighorn sheep after they're put in the program? And who's paying for that? Because I know the bighorn sheep does buy the land. They do put the sheep on, but there's a lot more cost. As a rancher, we know that. When you run cattle of any kind, somebody has to pay the price, and that's what I'm concerned about. Thank you.
Thank you. Mike, could you address that issue as to the budget?
Hunters
and Fishermen Fund 9 to pay for that.
The hunting licenses that that people pay do pay for the operation of all our wildlife management areas, some 750,000 acres of those. And this is a large area at Black Gap and a relatively small addition to that.
Right. In relation to the total, it's a small addition.
In relation to the total,
right.
Yes.
Thank you, Mike. Next up, I've got Mackie Shackelford on item 20.
My name is Mackie Shackelford, and me and my wife, I own this adjoining land of Black Gap area, just like she said, and I have also lived in the, in that area all my life. And the Parks and Wildlife had just taken three sections of land that I had leased from the General Land Office for the past 10 years, which didn't sit too good with me because it kind of ruined my operations. But I am against the acceptance of the 1,380 acres of land donated by the Bighorn Sheep Society, mainly because the Parks and Wildlife already has more land than they can manage. I understand the reason Parks and Wildlife wants this land is because of the Bighorn Sheep Program. The Bighorn Sheep Program is one of the reasons for the financial problems Parks and Wildlife is in now. The Bighorn Sheep Program today, like the one in the 1960s and 70s, is destined to fail. All the monies that has been spent in the last 45 years has been lost. I'm not bragging, but I know quite a bit about what has gone on with all the land trading. But it will take a lot more time than 3 minutes to explain it. There's one thing I don't know, and that is what in the world Parks and Wildlife is going to do with all the land they have acquired, not only in Brewster County, but in Presidio and Culberson counties also. Now, some of you may think I'm getting a little bit out of shape, but I think it's time someone started trying to straighten this mess out. And it is a mess. That's all.
Thank you, sir. Mike, could you tell us just very briefly the increase in numbers since the program started at Bighorn Sheep?
Well, the program started in the back in the 60s and 70s when Bighorn Sheep disappeared from the Trans-Pecos, and we've been on a reintroduction program and rebuilding program since then. And their numbers are, at last count as I can remember, well over 800 sheep. We haven't finished our counts this year, but the numbers so far preliminarily appear to be increased again this year over previous years. So we certainly believe the sheep program is a very successful program with the partnership of the Bighorn Society is doing very well.
I love the numbers would back you up there. Thank you. Any questions, comments on this, Ned? All right. Motion? All right. Who's the motion? Bivens?
Sure.
All right. Second, Holt, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Thank you. We'll move on, Ted, to item 21.
Chairman, Commissioners, I'm still Ted Hollingsworth with the Land Conservation Program. This final item also pertains to Black Gap Wildlife Management Area. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation is holding an easement on a 9,470-acre tract of land called the Adams Ranch. You can see in this wide view that it is a gap. It is a piece of property that was not formally under conservation, sandwiched between the Big Bend National Park and the Black Gap Wildlife Management Area. Here's a close-up. That area in blue is the property that comprises the Adams Ranch and on which the conservation easement is held. The request is that the conservation easement be transferred from the foundation to Texas Parks and Wildlife so that it can be monitored and managed by staff of the Wildlife Management Area consistent with the management of that property. And this is the motion before the commission.
And Ted, so this conservation easement is already in place?
It is already in place, yes.
And the decision by the landowner has already been made to enter, that's already done and negotiated. We're just transferring it from the foundation to the department.
Yes, sir. And it was actually entered into by the previous landowner who asked the foundation to take that because he wanted that conservation easement in place prior to selling the ranch to another party.
I see. So that decision was made by the previous landowner?
Yes, sir.
All right. Very good. Thank you. We have two people signed up on item 21, Marilyn Shackelford and Mackie Shackelford. Item 21.
On the conservation easement of the 9,470 acres of land, it not only gives the owner, the doctor who sold it to CMEX, and we're glad to have CMEX in our area, but the doctor who sold it asked for this easement, as we know in our part of the country, because we keep up with these kind of things, for a huge tax break. For those of you who don't know, he bought it for $141 an acre and sold it for $317 an acre 1 year later. And that easement gave him quite a bit of money for a tax break. And again, I feel like it puts a burden on the Black Gap employees and the Texas Parks and Wildlife. Somebody's got to take care of that easement, and it's not going to be the people that are living there. In fact, we were just hired as a contractor, my son and some of the family, to go down to the Adams Ranch and clean that place up. You have never seen anything like that. We shoveled a bat guano for 5 days at a houses. It was horrible. We cleaned it up, and it's in good shape now. And CMEX is getting ready to move in. We fixed the airstrip. My husband did the airstrip. We're doing the roads going in. And by the way, we do the roads from Black Gap into our ranch, and we do the roads from Black Gap into the Adams Ranch, because the employees just don't have the equipment at the time. And we're not complaining about that. We are glad to have the privilege to do that. But when you talk about these easements and somebody's got to go down and make sure the easements are in place, who's going to do that? Again, Texas Parks and Wildlife is responsible for it. I understand that most of these things in place before we walk in here, and our voice doesn't seem to mean a whole lot. But I think if you just sit back just for a little while and listen to some of the things that we say, we're there every day. We're there. Mr. Fitzsimmons, I know that you lived at Black Gap, I believe, for a while as a young boy. And I appreciate you being on this board because you know what we're talking about in that land. So think about some of these things. Consider us down there. We're in a very sparse area that people don't even see, don't even think about. You say, well, they don't. You know, Black Gap is the biggest park area, state park area in Texas and the least visited. And that concerns us because there's many beautiful things to see down there. That park should be a place where people can come to see. But if you put too many restraints on it, the first thing you know, people say, well, we can't go down there because we can't do anything. And I would really ask the commissioners to think about this and look at these situations before you vote, just because you've heard something from someone else, because we are an important part of Texas, and we're going to become more and more important as time goes on. And you're going to see that as the population is moving out in our direction, and I can grant you it's moving in our direction. And so please consider this and think about it, and think about these easements that you put on land and who takes care of them, and are they really taken care of in the correct way, and how much it costs to do that. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shackelford, Mackie Shackelford.
Well, the only thing I want to say about the conservation easement is I can't understand why Parks and Wildlife would want to take on a conservation easement on land that they don't even own. It's just another financial burden that you're going to add to your already financial burdens. And it just don't seem feasible to keep adding expenses to some, you know, where you're already strapped for money. And you need to look at that, I think.
All right, thank you. Mike, very briefly, could you explain the difference between parks and wildlife management areas? This is not a park.
These are wildlife management areas. They are not parks. They're not funded with Fund 64, which is really strapped. This is funded with Fund 9 from the sales of hunting and fishing licenses.
Thank you.
And restricted.
Just to clear that up, there's been a lot of talk about park funding. That has nothing to do with the wildlife management areas. They have
a
separate dedicated account that we actually receive.
That's correct.
Maybe just quickly explain the difference between a park and a wildlife management area, because I think there's a bit of confusion.
Right. I don't pretend to speak for Walt and the parks,
right.
but the parks are an area which are designed to attract a lot of attention to come out and use and enjoy these areas. The wildlife management areas are open to similar kinds of public use, but they are restricted because they're research and development areas. So we're not going to have the kind of intensive recreational activities on those areas that you might find on the state parks. So you would anticipate and expect a lower participation, a lower usage of those areas, just because of the remoteness of the area and the less development that's on those areas.
Thank you, Mike. Good explanation. Any other questions or comments on item 21, the conservation easement donation? Entertain a motion.
Second.
Motion by Holmes, second by Parker. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion passes. And next step, need to recess. Executive session. Now recess to executive session. Like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 of the Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of personnel matters, annual evaluation of the executive director under Section 551.074 of the Texas Open Meetings Act, and then we will reconvene afterwards to adjourn the meeting. Thank you. This isn't enough. She's official.
Yeah. What? the staff to the railroad, they drop that off.
Don't open it, John, until we're all gone. I can't see it exploding.
What's John been promising?
I don't know.
Yeah, John. He's getting presents already.
Take one.